From the Moon Broadcast Center at KPCC, this is The Frame. I'm John Horn, and happy Friday, everybody. On today's show, the music business is tough, and some promoters are still paying radio stations for airtime, how the practice of payola lives on. Then comedian Julio Torres is an immigrant who follows the news, but he's not one for getting too political in his work.
I think that my brain is not fully wired in that wonderful way that so many comedians have of like reading the news and immediately making it funny. An hour later, I sort of need time.
And an episode of Song Exploder with Corin Tucker and Kerry Brownstein from Slater Kinney. All that coming up on The Frame. Have you ever listened to a track on a major market radio station and thought, I wonder who decided on this song? Well, there's a chance that a promoter, a label, or a musician paid the station for that airtime. It's called payola. And while payola has been around for decades and is actually illegal, Rolling Stone writer Elias Light says it's a real thing even today.
Payola has been a fairly constant feature of radio since really after World War II. And early on, there were some sort of major payola cases. Alan Freed, the radio DJ who famously coined the term rock and roll, was involved in a payola scandal in the late 50s and early 60s that led the FCC to prohibit undisclosed pay-for-play. And then during the 70s and 80s, there have been a number of books written about sort of widespread payola, where there were people bringing envelopes of cash, and there was a whole term called drugola, which involved exchanging drugs for airplay. More recently, though, there were a couple major investigations, the one in the mid-2000s by Eliot Spitzer when he was the Attorney General of New York. And so the practice kind of changed, and it's not as overt as it was in the days when you think about envelopes of cash.
And I think you talked to one industry individual who paid $50,000 for airplay. So what is the trade-off? You get the cash. What does the label or the independent promoter get in return? What is the benefit?
So in that particular individual's case, he was just paying DJs directly to play his records. So from his point of view, he's trying to break an artist. And one way to do that is to get a radio hit. It's not the only way, but certainly it is a popular way, is to get your music all over the radio. So he paid $50,000. The way he put it was, I bought all my spins in the right places. He got about 800 plays on the radio, and the DJs get a little bit of money, and he's hoping that that record becomes a hit.
It reminds me of the joke, which I think is grounded in reality, that if you want to be a best-selling author, the best thing to do is have a best-selling book, because then you're at the front of the store, you get the best shelf space, you get promoted, people notice you. Is that the same idea with payola, that you get more radio play and then you start rising on the charts and people say, what is that song? Who is that artist? That it all starts to feed on itself and it really kind of separates songs from the rest of the pack.
So especially in modern radio, programmers rarely want to step out and play a record that they don't know is already working somewhere else. So they check the charts regularly. They check their colleagues' playlists regularly. So if you can kind of show that you're getting some traction on some radio station somewhere, you can then take that story to another radio station and say, hey, look, I'm getting played over here, so why don't you play me over here?
What really struck me about the story is how casual all of this seems. It's almost like you're talking to people who are, you know, selling gift wrap at a store. It's just what they do as their day job. And I'm wondering, it's all illegal, right? I mean, they know that they're breaking the law, and why isn't it being tracked down, and why isn't it being enforced?
So I think the first difficulty with anything like this is that, especially now as compared to the 70s, the 80s, even the 90s, any activity that sort of fits this description is done not out in the open, right? It's much more secretive. And the second difficulty when it comes to enforcing something like this is that the FCC regulations around payola are actually quite weak. So we had someone at the FCC actually say to us that he thought it was extremely common for there to be financial transactions that were taking place between stations and labels, but he described it as basically exploiting loopholes in the law. So they kind of find ways around the constraints that are in place.
We're talking with Elias Light, a reporter from Rolling Stone. So much of music is now listened to on streaming platforms or on YouTube. Is there any suggestion that payola has drifted into that realm and could be influencing the way that playlists are put together and music is promoted on streaming sites?
I think in this story, we didn't go down that particular route of trying to determine if there is streaming service payola. I think one thing about streaming, though, is that it has really changed the calculation for radio payola. So in the old days, the idea was that if you made a radio hit, that would generate physical sales in a market, which would bring back healthy profits for an artist and a label. But now really no one buys music anymore. No one really downloads music anymore. Everyone just streams. And streams only generate, you know, fractions of a cent at a time for an artist. So if you're paying for radio play, you have to generate a very large number of streams to make your money back.
So payola can affect radio play. Can it actually help break an artist? Can it be that meaningful?
One of the things that people talked about in our story was that it can make it complicated, because if you are potentially paying for radio play and your song does start to get some traction at radio, you actually don't know why it's getting traction, in terms of you don't know if people actually like the song or if you are just getting this play due to your payments. So then when you're trying to think about what the next steps for an artist are, like how you're going to route a tour or what your follow-up single might be, you actually don't have a lot of information to go on, because you started potentially by paying for spins.
Elias Light is a reporter at Rolling Stone. He's the author of the article, "Want to Get on the Radio? Have $50,000. Elias, thanks so much for coming on the show.
Yeah, thank you so much for having me.
Coming up on The Frame, Julio Torres is very interested in small objects, and he's turned his obsession into an HBO comedy special. In the decades since Julio Torres left El Salvador for the United States, he's made a name for himself with his often absurdist sense of humor. Saturday Night Live, where Torres is a writer, is on summer hiatus, but Torres has still been busy with the premieres of two shows on HBO, the comedic horror series Los Espookies and his new comedy special, My Favorite Shapes. Torres said he always wanted to move to New York. He just didn't know he would become a comedian.
You know, I wanted to write. I wanted to write for TV. I wanted to write for film. I went to the New York School and got an English degree. And then I graduated still wanting to be a writer of funny things, as I thought about it back then. It occurred to me, like a year later, that stand-up was the quickest, most efficient solution to the problem of how do I showcase my writing without spending any money in a way that is fast, in a way where I don't need to know anyone in the industry, in a way that I don't have to like even collaborate with people. Because doing open mics, it's like fairly democratic that way. You don't need to know anyone. You don't have to pay anyone for classes. You don't have to rent out a space. You can just go up and do it and take it from there.
I want to play a clip that suggests that you believe in reincarnation.
I just know in my heart that I was the Trojan guard who saw the Trojan horse approach the gates and was like, let it in. Oh my God, it's a big, f-ing beautiful horse. Open the gates and let it in. No questions, I don't care.
There's such an honesty to that idea that you are responding to the beauty of this horse, and you have like a little miniature horse that I have to say, it looks at first glance like it's made out of popsicle sticks, but it's much more beautiful than that. I'm wondering, at what point did you figure out that you could do an entire show about shapes and then have what I'll call the the heightened sushi conveyor belt, bringing objects by with your little foot pedal to advance the tray of delights.
So I've been finding objects to be very funny from a very young age. My mom is an architect and my dad is a civil engineer. Sometimes they would make fun of poorly designed spaces or like poorly designed objects. Everything in my home was always very considered. We didn't have a lot of space, so every inch mattered deeply. So I think the combination of having an appreciation for good design while a humor about poor design was something that was always in my mind. And then, like, you know, years later, starting to do comedy, I kept being, like, stimulating by objects, but I didn't know how I could possibly do essentially a stand-up show where I would show small objects and talk about them until I realized that I could hook up a cord to my iPhone and project small objects onto a screen live that I found sort of the tools and the vessel that I needed to do a live show around small objects.
We're talking with writer and comedian Julio Torres about his new special, My Favorite Shapes. One of the things I really love about the objects is that in many cases, they're things that we look at and don't really understand the role that they play. You kind of imagine yourself speaking as the object that you're about to show.
Okay, well, I'm sorry if you don't like what I do, and I'm sorry if you don't like what I stand for, but I actually keep the economy going, and my job is pretty important. I'm sorry if you can handle that, but we live in a nation of laws and rules are rules. I'm sorry if you can handle that. That is that nasty little curtain that divides first class from coach. And look, I understand that it's a job and that some curtain has to do it, but to be a curtain and pick that as your curtain job is like, who hurt you? Why?
How quickly did you realize that that kind of comedy matched your sensibility, that there's a way to imbue these objects with a story that matched what you wanted to say comically?
There's not really a calculated process behind what I do. It's not like I think, okay, so I figured out the formula. I find an object, and then I come up with a little story behind it. It's more like I'm just going about my day, noticing things, and then giggling to myself, and then thinking, okay, this, I think, is another one for the show. I think that the real work, writing-wise, came in curating the show, being like, okay, so I have this... I have all these objects that I'm really excited by. How do I organize them in a way that makes sense and flows and feels like the viewer leaves with a greater something, that they add up to a greater whole? And I hope they do.
I want to play a scene from your HBO series Los Spookies about your character Andres.
Soy adoptado. Me encontraron de bebé en medio de una tormenta eléctrica.
I'm adopted. They found me on the doorstep of a church. The priest told my parents, be careful with this kid. There's something mysterious about him, something dark. It is a crazy series. What was the original conversation and how much were you able to help shape the show?
Oh my God, it was a dream scenario. So Fred Armisen, who I've admired for such a long time, asked me if I wanted to write and or be in a show that he was thinking about. And the idea that he had was a show about a group of friends in Latin America who were very into horror and horror makeup. And the show would be entirely in Spanish. And I was very excited to do it and also very excited to find out that he was also talking to my friend Anna Fabrega. And then together we wrote the pilot. And then Anna and I took it from there and wrote the other 5 episodes. We really got to do the show that we wanted to do.
I want to ask you about how you figure what the balance is in comedy between what's topical and what's not. Because you used to do a Saturday Night Live sketch called Melania Moments.
Melania Trump approached a window in Trump Tower and gazed down on Fifth Avenue. She saw a man walk just out of sight and wondered, what happens to them? To the people, once they leave Fifth Avenue? Where do they go?
At a certain point, you decided it was no longer funny. How do you figure out what that balance is? And does Melania Moments kind of tell you what is and is not good political comedy?
I think that those videos are the closest I've gotten to doing something, or one of the few instances where I've done something that was very topical. This was back when Donald Trump was a candidate. And I think at the time, not even fully a front runner. And so the take, or my perception, and I think the general public's perception of Melania shifted from, you know, princess trapped in a castle to maybe not so trapped. As for how I strike the balance between something that's topical and something that will be evergreen or long-lasting, I think that my brain is not fully wired in that wonderful way that so many comedians have of, like, reading the news and immediately making it funny an hour later. I sort of need time, and then usually the things that I come up with are not of the day, but I think hopefully you can revisit them years later and have them still make sense.
I'm going to cite something you wrote yesterday on your Instagram feed. It was a very personal and very interesting post. And you said, I got my green card in the mail about a month ago, a little over a decade after moving to the U.S. People have said to me, as sort of a compliment, that I'm a good example, that it's good that I'm out there representing good, hardworking immigrants, proving we can be good, creative people, and even alternative comedians. Sure, except the bad examples, the ones actually labeled invaders, are often just people with no choice but to break laws just to survive.
I find a certain level of responsibility, and that it could be, like, good to whomever reads it to share my earnest point of view in those regards. Maybe because my comedy is not political, not in the most obvious way. I don't face things head on in my work. I'm not a Seth Meyers. I'm not a Trevor Noah. I work mostly through metaphor. So because of that, I feel like I find the need to every now and then carve out a little, like, time out. This is what I'm thinking about this. And yeah, like, something that I've been thinking a lot about is this notion that to just bring home the truth that people who come here illegally or seeking asylum don't love that they have to do that. They don't want to come here. They wish they could be thriving where they're from.
Julio Torres is a writer and comedian, co-creator of the series Los Spookies. His comedy special is called My Favorite Shapes. Julio, thank you so much for coming on the show.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
Los Spookies will be back for a second season. My Favorite Shapes premieres on August 10th on HBO. Next on The Frame, a new episode of Song Exploder with the band Slater Kinney. The band Slater Kinney was formed in 1994 by Corin Tucker and Kerry Brownstein. Drummer Janet Weiss left the band this year, but she did perform on their latest album titled The Center Won't Hold. In this episode from the podcast Song Exploder, Tucker and Brownstein break down how the song The Future Is Here was made.
This is Corin Tucker from Slater Kinney.
And this is Kerry Brownstein, also from Slater Kinney. So Corin was visiting me in LA, and I said, there's this really great performance art / comedy night that I go to once a month at Zebulon. It's called Weirdo Night. And we saw a performer named Joseph Koechler there, who is basically an opera singer.
The strangers from the internet are standing outside. The strangers from the internet have come from far and wide.
There was a whole performance art aspect to his performance as well.
Yeah, it was beautiful and funny and
sad.
Yeah, a little heartbreaking. Anyway, I feel like you wrote this song after that.
I did. And we kept talking about, like, what if we had, like, a male voice on the album? You know, what if it's a duet? And I just did it on a whim of like, I got inspired by Weirdo Night and, you know, threw this thing down on my computer. I really loved it because I wrote the verse in a lower register than I've sang on a Slater Kinney record.
I stopped my day on a telescope, tried to connect the world, they're right in front of me.
And I think I sent it to Carrie and she was like, yeah, I like it.
Yeah, I don't hear Corinne singing very low. You know, she doesn't use that register. And, you know, as someone who appreciates the high caterwaul, scrawling version of Corinne's voice, we've called that the tool before in our band. It's a very powerful singing voice. But, you know, when you've been working with someone for so long and you hear something that sounds different, I think your ear is drawn to that. And I was really enthused by it. And also, I don't know, it was kind of sexy but disaffected.
And I was like, okay, well, should we get a hold of Joseph Koeckler and ask him to sing it? I think Annie was like, no, I want you to sing it.
The producer on this album is Annie Clark, who also goes by St. Vincent. She is a very accomplished singer, songwriter, guitarist, and a friend of ours.
When Annie listened to the demo, she really liked it, but she was like, well, definitely you should be singing this. I was like, really? I liked the idea of like a male perspective and female perspective coming together and singing together on the chorus. So for her to say, well, no, I really want you to sing it, I was like, well, it still needs to me to be two different characters. So I wanted to make the two vocals very different from each other.
I start my day on a tiny screen. I end my day on a tiny screen. Try to connect the words that are right in front of me.
I had this freedom on my mind that I was actually writing for a male singer, but to then take that and explore just being that character myself was very freeing. There's so many different voices that a songwriter can explore that don't have to be tied to your own gender or your own body in any way. That's a really freeing element of writing.
I start my day on a tiny screen, try to connect the words that are right in front of me.
The vocals kind of dictate where everything else is going to land and what sort of space it takes up sonically. So Corinne has this great melody. I'll find my way into it, around it.
I end my day on a tiny screen. I try to reach for you through the empty sheets.
I still think with Corinne and I in terms of point, counterpoint, and even when I'm not singing counter to her, which we haven't done on a couple records, actually, I still think of my guitar as a conversational element in our songs, playing off her vocal melody.
I wanted something that was like kind of a backbeat for the song that sounded like this churning industrial city.
And then when Janet came in, obviously, Janet drummed on it. You know, if we were like sending stuff back and forth, we would send without drums. Because it's just like you want a drummer to have a sense of possibility. So it was like, you can listen to this program stuff or here's the version without it to just come in fresh. And the songs would really take a leap with the real drums.
The Nanas were a guitar line that I had as the bridge.
Oh, and right.
And she was like, oh, that, we're going to do that
right
in the chorus as a Nana.
Na, 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 na.
Lots of layering of those vocals. The verses speak of a sense of loneliness. They're sung alone, and the choruses come in, and the narrator is joined by many, many people. This song does deal with a lot of despair and themes that are murky and a little bit hard to wade through. So we wanted to counter that with catchiness and also with a bunch of people singing so that you might feel less alone.
You can hear a longer version of that session at songexploder.net. And that's all for this week. The Frame is produced by Oscar Garza, Darby Maloney, Jonathan Shiflett, Julia Paskin, and Robert Garova. Our news clerk is Andrea Gutierrez, and our intern is Paul Ratliff. Valentina Rivera is the show's engineer, and our opening theme music is by Taylor McFerrin. I'm John Horn. We're back here on Monday at the Moen Broadcast Center. Have a great weekend.